fascinating facts, candid conversations, and some levity to lighten your day. This is the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
A marvelous Monday to you. Hashtag Maverick Monday. Can you believe that they made Top Gun Day on the Feast of the Ascension? I couldn't believe that, but boy, talk about a hop going up. That was it. And we're going to go up, up, and away on the show today. I can't wait. We've got some awesome stuff to talk about. 1-888-914-9149 is the studio line to call. Believe it or not, it's been a year. Today is the one-year anniversary of the airing of the final episode of The Last Dance, which was really a phenomenon during the beginning of the outbreak of the pandemic last year. And we're going to talk about that. I want to ask you this question. We're going to talk about meeting Michael Jordan in person, how intimidating that was. But have you ever met your hero? And if so, what was that like? Was it a letdown? Was it more than you expected? 1-888-914-9149 is a toll-free line to call on the Cale Clark Show. You can also email the show, cale@relevantradio.com. And the Twitter handles are as follows. My personal account, at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. And the Cale Clark Show account is... just like I said it, Cale Clark Show, at Cale Clark Show on Twitter. But before we get to that, you know, it's not often that a nun is profiled in the New York Times, especially when her main topic of conversation is death. She's the nun who wants you to remember that you will die. And who am I talking about? I'm talking about Sister Teresa Alethea Noble, who's one of the Daughters of St. Paul, and she was profiled in Friday's New York Times by Ruth Graham. And this is incredible. This has become this worldwide phenomenon. Maybe you heard a lot about it, especially during Lent. It's become, there's merchandise involved. There's a series of books. And how did this all get started? Well, before she became a nun in 2010, Sister Teresa Noble had a biography of the founder of the order, who was an Italian priest, Father Alberione, James Alberione, who founded the Daughters of St. Paul. He was born in the 1880s, and he used to keep a ceramic skull on his desk as a reminder of the inevitability of death. And so Sister Teresa, who was a punk rock fan as a teenager, she thought it was very... Patrick Madrid was just trying to call me. Sorry about that. I don't know if you heard that. Siri said, Patrick Madrid is online. Doesn't he know I have a show right now? He should know that. After all, he's one of the Relevant Radio personalities. Anyways, you never know when you're going to get a commercial interruption from one of the other hosts on Relevant Radio. But at any rate, Sister Teresa Alethea, she thought that the fact that the founder of the religious order that she was going to join used to go about with a ceramic skull on his desk all the time. She thought it was, quote, super punk rock. And I know, Lucas, you really love that, right? This idea of super punk rock. Were you a punk rocker back in the day?
I was. I'm not going to lie. I was. So when I was reading this by Sister Teresa Alethea, I was like, yes, I can resonate with this experience because I was totally in that scene in high school with like playing shows and going to like local underground punk rock concerts. And I could totally have seen myself being like Skull and Crossbones for buttons on a backpack. Yes, most definitely.
So well, now I'm really happy that you've graduated to No Doubt and Justin Bieber and a little bit more. It's a little bit more humane, I think. But anyways, we'll talk about this a little bit more in just a moment. But so Sister Alethea has sort of glommed onto this idea, and she's made this her thing. And ever since 2017, she's made it her mission to revive this practice. This is really an ancient Catholic practice of memento mori. And that's a Latin phrase that means remember your death. And the idea is, as Stephen Covey once said in The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, begin with the end in mind. And really the concept is focus on your death because it's inevitable, A. And this can actually help you live in the present moment a lot better. But this has become incredibly easy for people to try to ignore this reality. And Lucas, you also texted me about a book that was quite popular in the 1970s. I'm just going to find this text that you pulled up. And I hadn't read this myself, but we even heard of it. It's called The Denial of Death by Ernest Becker. And thanks for pulling that up. And I don't know if any of you listeners remember this, but this came out in 1973. And ironically, Ernest Becker passed away very shortly after the book was released. And he received the Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction for this book in 1974, 2 months after he passed away. And the basic premise of the book is that human civilization is an elaborate symbolic defense mechanism against the knowledge of mortality. And he talks about human immortality projects. People want to join things that they feel like will last after they died, some great cause, that sort of thing. There are all kinds of ways in which we elaborately try to avoid the reality of death, and everything from beauty products to, I don't know, cryogenics, oil of delay, as I like to call it. I could probably put some under my eyes. I've been some sleepless nights recently. But having said that, this is something that people generally don't want to think about, don't want to talk about. However, Sister Noble has found this incredible, incredible audience who's really into this. And the pandemic and the fact that death has been in our face for the past year has really brought this to light in a new way. And she was quoted in the New York Times, Sister Noble, as saying, quote, "My life is going to end and I have a limited amount of time. We naturally tend to think of our lives as continuing and continuing." And that's very true. It's not something that we picture. We think about other people dying. We may have had loved ones who have passed away. But when it comes to our own death, it's a bit of a different ballgame. And so she started promoting this back in 2017, and people will now send her coffee mugs with skulls and crossbones on them, skull rosaries in the mail. They get tattoos with this phrase, memento mori, and a skull and crossbones on their biceps. It's just all over the place. And so this has become this huge social media thing, and she's got a massive following now on Twitter. And like I said, the nuns have kind of capitalized on this by writing books about this. There's a memento mori prayer journal, merchandise with a skull on it. And I think it's actually been helpful. It's been a way to evangelize. And she says in the New York Times that suffering and death are facts of life. Focusing only on the bright and shiny is superficial and inauthentic. We try to suppress the thought of death or escape it or run away from it because we think that's where we'll find happiness. But it's actually in facing the darkest realities of life that we find light in them. And so, again, this is a venerable Catholic practice. Saint Benedict, he always instructed his monks back in the 6th century to keep death daily before your eyes. It's also, obviously, something that's a theme in other religions of the world and other philosophies of the world. Buddhism talks about being mindful of one's death. Socrates, Seneca talked about the idea of practicing death. I'm not quite sure what they meant by that, but it's just a way to find some focus for your own life. And for most of human history, and the article talks about this, that for most of history, people died at much younger ages than they do today. Because of advances in medicine, people are, and nutrition, people are living a lot longer than they used to. There's no question about it. But in Jesus's time, lifespans were not very great. If you've ever seen a movie about Jesus of Nazareth, you know, when he's on trial before the high priest Caiaphas, it's usually some actor who's got a long white beard, looks very aged. In reality, Caiaphas was probably maybe 50 years old at most. Lifespans were, that was really kind of on the long end of things in Jesus's day. So this idea of a long life, comparatively speaking. Now, I know in the book of Genesis, there are long lifespans, and we talked about this on our sister program, The Faith Explained, and hundreds of years in some cases, and it kind of got whittled down to an ideal of 120 years. But eventually, the effects of sin in the world took their toll in the creation, and lifespans began to be a lot shorter. But for most of human history, that's the way it was. Death was all around. You couldn't forget it. It was always in your face. But again, because of the pandemic over the last 12 months, it's become incredibly relevant, this idea of memento mori and really, there's no better group to promote this idea than the Daughters of St. Paul. They're media nuns. That's what their order is all about. They want to use the most modern means of media to reach people. And usually that's meant book publishing. You probably come across the Daughters of St. Paul in their bookstores all across North America. They do a great job with this and around the world as well. But lately, they've been branching out into social media. And in December, Sister Noble, the Memento Mori nun herself, was in a TikTok video that was viewed over 4.4 million times. I've been kind of avoiding TikTok. I think most social media is a waste of time. But there's no question that it does reach a lot of people. And that's an incredible number, 4.4 million views. So at any rate, Sister Noble, apparently, Lucas, was a lot like you growing up. She used to listen to the Dead Kennedys. She went to local punk rock shows with her friends. She's 40 years old now. But she actually was struggling with atheism growing up. Her father has a PhD in theology, and he worked for a Catholic diocese for a while. But she became kind of a skeptic, and when she was a teenager, she declared herself an atheist. And apparently when she was in university, and I've heard her being interviewed about this in other media outlets, that she actually was the leader of an animal rights club at Bryn Mawr College. And she started kind of getting her back up a little bit because they started talking about speciesism. And she thought, okay, she thought there is a difference between human beings and animals. And she just kind of had this concept. Maybe she didn't quite call it the soul. Maybe she didn't want to be that specific about it, but she knew that there was a difference between animals and human beings. And she started to do some service projects, went to Costa Rica, worked on an organic farm, and she had a conversion experience there. And she was dating somebody at the time. And when her boyfriend actually picked her up at the airport after this trip, she broke up with him and ditched her plans to go to law school. And within 4 years, she was in the convent wearing a habit. How about that? So she at one point shared Memento Mori tweets for more than 500 days in a row on Twitter. And yeah, that's basically it. So she didn't necessarily think this was going to be a phenomenon that was going to take off. She just kind of wanted to work on this for her own practice, share what she was thinking about in her spiritual life. But it kind of took on a life of its own. And this has expanded now to, like I said, a lot of merchandise, sweatshirts, books, all kinds of things. And so I think that's pretty cool. I think it's amazing. And as she says in the New York Times, and I quote, "Remembering death keeps us awake, focused, and ready for whatever might happen, both the excruciatingly difficult and the breathtakingly beautiful." End of quote. And I think that's one of the graces that's come out of the pandemic. A lot of people, maybe you, have experienced the loss of a loved one during the pandemic, and there's a lot of death all around us at all times, but this is really brought it in our face. We try to shove it away, like Ernest Becker said in his book in the 1970s. We try so many things to avoid thinking about it. But maybe that's one of the graces of all this, is that we do start dealing with the unavoidable and getting ready for it and trying to live really well. I remember reading, and she since passed away, a correspondent who used to work for the Toronto Star newspaper, and she was embedded in Afghanistan with the troops for quite a while during the last decade. And she said that, you know, it was a very, very dangerous time, but she never felt more alive than when she was hanging out with these guys and they're out on the road and they don't know whether they're going to run over a landmine or come up against enemy fire from the Taliban. It was dangerous. She was embedded there, but she said, "I've never felt more alive knowing that I could possibly die." And I do think it does bring life into focus. Death should bring life into focus and help us to live well. And actually, if you want a little bit more information on that, check out the Faith Explained program tomorrow. And if you can't listen to it live, you can check out the podcast. We call it Class After Mass, 12:30 Central on Relevant Radio, right after the Daily Mass. We're going to be looking at the death of Joseph. It's the end of the book of Genesis, but I'm going to try to jump from there into how we can practically prepare for our own death and help other people around us as well. So it's a faith-building experience for them. And that's everything from planning for your funeral to making sure that that we have help ourselves when we're facing the afterlife, because like taxes, and today's tax day too. How about that? I didn't even plan that. Death and taxes, the two things we can't avoid. But one of them leads to us being born to eternal life. And that's the goal. That's the goal. You're listening to the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio, 1-888-914-9149. We will be right back after this quick break. And I'll tell you about one man who met Michael Jordan and changed his life.
This is the Cale Clark Show.
And now, your host for the Cale Clark Show. He's 5'11", has a good three-point shot, and is a PGA Tour wannabe. From Coal Harbor, Nova Scotia, Cale Clark.
And the crowd goes wild. All right. Thank you, Jim Shaper, and that's Relevant Radio's own Jim Shaper, who may not be with us long. The Chicago Bulls might want him as their in-game announcer after that. Wow, thanks, Jim. That's a great intro. Appreciate that. And of course, a little Chicago Bulls reference for you, because today, May the 17th, 1 year ago today, the final episode of The Last Dance documentary series aired, which was, of course, and you can still see it on Netflix. It's still there. It's a 10-part series that explores Michael Jordan, the Chicago Bulls, the rise of their dynasty through the lens of their final championship season in 1997-1998, in that year. And we don't want to talk about the Washington Wizards years with Michael Jordan, although I did see him play with the Wizards, Lucas. That was the one time I saw Michael Jordan play live. They came to play the Raptors and had to go check it out, had to go see his airness. And of course, this was this documentary series became a lot bigger than sports. In just a moment, I'm going to talk about how the director of this docuseries first met Michael Jordan and got this ball rolling, got it off the ground. And if you've ever met somebody that you admired, your hero or someone like this, someone of that stature, I want to hear about this. What was that experience like for you? Was it a letdown? Was it a positive thing? 1-888-914-9149. I remember the first time I met Patrick Madrid, and I realized, wow, his mustache is real. I probably shouldn't have pulled on it. But nonetheless, maybe that's why he called me today. Maybe he tried to call me during the show a few minutes ago. Maybe don't tell that story. Don't worry. It was real. I'm not going to say anything otherwise, Patrick, but Jason Ayer, and it's kind of funny that his name is Jason Ayer because, he of course, was interviewing his Aaroness, Michael Jordan, about, his history with the Chicago Bulls. And obviously this project, The Last Dance, was so needed. It was such a relief for people in the midst of the pandemic. Because remember, at this point, everything had shut down. Everything had shut down. There was literal terror and panic in the streets. There was nothing on television. All professional sports had shut down. The Kentucky Derby was canceled. The NBA shut down. The NHL shut down. Major League Baseball, there was really nothing going on, and there was a lot of fear, and this provided a respite. There was two episodes that would appear every Sunday night between April 19th and May 17th, 2020, and it was really quite a relief. Here's a little clip you can listen to. Check this out.
You guys not allowed? No, I'm just kidding.
What time is it?
My mentality was to go out and win at any cost.
Jordan is the most talented player in the NBA by far.
The show of the 90s, the team of the 90s.
How you feeling?
Whenever they speak Michael Jordan, they should speak Scottie Pippen.
We created an image that people want to live up to. I think that's all you can hope for.
All right, and of course, Jerry Seinfeld was in there. We had to get Seinfeld in there. A little Hello Newman action. We might have some Hello Newman coming up later in the program. But in the Chicago Tribune, Dan Weiderer had a great, great article, and we'll link to it in the show notes, about it's really a behind-the-scenes look at how this docuseries was created. And even if you don't like sports, it's an amazing human interest story, how this came together during the pandemic, because they were already making this, but ESPN asked the creators of The Last Dance to move their schedule up by a lot, like 6 weeks in advance, because they're like, there's nothing on television. We want to get this thing on the air. Can you do it? And it became this impossible task. But I want to tell you about how the director, Jason Eyre, met Michael Jordan for the first time. And this was narrated by Dan Weiderer in the Chicago Tribune. It says, the text vibrated on a Wednesday evening in September 2017 with Eyre in his living room and in his gym clothes, readying to head to the boxing gym where he often blew off steam. Sudden change of plans. Este Portnoy, Michael Jordan's manager, had reached out, text him with a last-minute invitation. Park Hyatt, Midtown Manhattan. How soon can you get there? Michael Jordan had wanted to chat. The only problem is it was already after 6 o'clock p.m., and Jason Eyre didn't have a helicopter. He didn't have a teleporting device to get around rush hour traffic. So he took a deep breath, quick change of clothes, threw on a suit with no tie, and called an Uber. And he was just stewing as he was sitting through traffic, realizing there's no way I can make this any faster. So he said, I've got to stick to the plan. I've never met Michael Jordan before, but I've got to keep this encounter casual but brief. Just one drink and leave. I want to leave with Michael Jordan agreeing to do this, agreeing to partner with us, and I want him to have confidence in me. And so while he was riding over in this Uber drive, Jason Eyre, the director of The Last Dance, he got a text from one of his friends saying, what drink do you order when you're meeting Michael Jordan? And he's like, oh, man, why'd you have to ask me that? That's another thing I'm going to have to worry about. Obviously, I can't order something that's considered kind of wimpy by his airness. And Jordan, obviously, is well known for his enjoyment of red wine. But Jason Eyre is allergic to that. So he's like, oh, man, this guy's an alpha male. What I can't say to him, red wine makes my throat tickle. What do I say? And if you saw the documentary, you know this, that Michael Jordan is an alpha. I mean, in the 1992 Olympics, the dream team, this was like Michael Jackson and the Beatles all rolled into one. Every possible star in the basketball universe was there. Larry Bird, Magic Johnson, Charles Barkley, John Stockton, you name it, the greatest stars of a generation. And Michael Jordan was the uncontested leader of all of them. What he said, where they're going to go to eat, that's what happened. So it's pretty intimidating to meet somebody like that. So eventually Jason Eyre said, all right, here's what we're going to do. I'm just going to order a Jameson on the rocks. Got to go with my Irish heritage here. That's the call. So he jumps out of the Uber and he steps into the most pressure-filled meeting of his life. And he said in the article in the Chicago Tribune, it was like when you were a kid playing video games and you had to beat all the henchmen before you get to the big boss. Well, when I came off that elevator and walked into that room, I'm thinking to myself, okay, we're in the boss's lair here. This is the last person I have to defeat to win this game. So he needed to get Michael Jordan's buy-in to understand how much research he had done on this, to tell the story, the official story of the Bulls dynasty and Jordan, who of course led that. And he had to be clear with him. Listen, we're going to leave no stone unturned here. We're going to talk about some uncomfortable things. Your gambling habits, Michael Jordan. All the conspiracy theories surrounding your first retirement with the Bulls. The murder of his father, James Jordan. The label that was put on Jordan that he kind of gave into the corporate world and didn't want to talk about social issues, didn't want to rock the boat. And of course, there was that famous 2009 induction speech that Michael Jordan gave when he was put into the Basketball Hall of Fame. And Jordan thought it was going to come across a lot differently, but it came across as a petty attack on everybody who never believed in him during his career. The chip on his shoulder was still very much there. And this past weekend, actually, Jordan delivered the induction address for Kobe Bryant, the late Kobe Bryant, as he was inducted this past weekend. So at any rate, it was interesting because Jason Eyre said he was talking to Michael Jordan, and then all of a sudden, he just kind of turned on a dime, and he said he turned from being a normal dude into the statue. And what I think he means by that is not that he was a mobile or anything like that, but it was probably a reference to that famous statue of Michael Jordan dunking on somebody that's in the lobby of the United Center in Chicago, this classic pose. And it's like, wow, at the drop of a hat, he just transformed into the legend. He said it was almost cinematic. he stuck his finger across the table and it looked like it was 2 feet long. And he said, holy bleep, that's Michael Jordan. He saw his golden earring, hoop earring glinting in the light. It's like, whoa. And he started to get really, really intimidating. And so that's a lot of what this documentary is about. And if you've seen it, it's about the intense, almost maniacal drive to win that Jordan had, the machete sharp edge that he would use to push his teammates to greater heights. But he was considered a tyrant by many. That's a lot of what this is about, how he got to be the way he was and maybe how he's been misunderstood in a lot of ways. So it's an incredible documentary, and you got to read this article. We'll link to it. It's in the Chicago Tribune, and it's a behind-the-scenes look at The Last Dance by Dan Weiderer. And just one more quick thing before we get to your calls. Lots of great calls here, and you can call in. If you've met somebody who was a hero to you, was that a letdown? Was that an interesting moment for you? Did you maybe get more out of that than you thought you would? 1-888-914-9149 is a toll-free line to call on The Cale Clark Show. And it was really interesting. Just one cool thing from a human sort of human interest point that I got out of this article too is that the team that was making this documentary, they were working together in person before COVID hit, but then they were really at the forefront of this whole working from home movement after that. Everything went to Zoom meetings, and they just couldn't brainstorm with each other. They couldn't tinker with stuff. And anytime you wanted to talk to somebody, you had to send them an email or a text message, and then somebody had to respond to that. It would just take 10 hours longer than it would just having a quick 5-minute conversation with somebody. But one of the guys who's on the team, producer Mark Maxson, talked about having to load up video clips on these drives, these G-RAID 35-pound, 32-terabyte drives. These were really heavy suckers that had to carry all this video that they needed to edit. And he would drive it around on his bicycle around Manhattan to the various team members that were working on the documentary. And Mark Maxson in this story was saying, man, how incredibly suffocating COVID was in New York at that time, in early 2020. There was nobody on the streets. It was just eerie. He was driving his bike through Central Park, looking at softball fields where he used to play ball growing up. And there were now grounds for hospital tents, and he would just break down. He said it was straight out of that movie, I Am Legend, if you've ever seen that movie with Will Smith, the sort of post-apocalyptic tale. And it's easy now to forget just how scary those days were. But he would just drive around thinking, this is completely messed up. So how they were able to pull this off, you know, with all the time pressures and everything that was at stake, it's a really interesting read. So you should definitely check that out in the Chicago Tribune. As I said, we'll link to it in the show notes. We're going to go to the phones right now. Nancy is calling from Mount Prospect, Illinois. Nancy, welcome to the show.
Hi, Cale. I do have to add to the Michael Jordan anecdote here with a classic. So I'm 40. I grew up in Chicago, and of course, Bulls are your childhood. And about 1990, my dad gets us tickets to go, and the old Chicago Stadium had a gate labeled Gate 3.5 where the players would come in and out of. So right after a game, we run down there to get an autograph. I've got all my basketball cards with me, and it happened so fast that Michael Jordan was walking right past you. So I grab my cards, I give one to him, and I said, oh, can you sign this, please? He looked at it, he chuckled, and he gave it back to me and just kept walking. So it happened so fast that you don't know what's going on. And I looked at the card. I had given him John Paxson's card. And so
I'm not signing Paxson's card.
If you look up Bonehead, there might be a picture of me there. So very missed opportunity there.
Oh, that's a great story, though. That's a great story, Nancy. Mm-hmm. That's really good. And I've never met Michael Jordan in person, but I do know somebody who did. Kind of a friend of a friend, and he was a trainer for the Toronto Raptors. And you might recall, of course, Charles Oakley, the Oak Man, who was kind of Jordan's bodyguard on the Bulls for a little while. And Jordan was really upset when he was traded to the New York Knicks. And that was, of course, the Bill Cartwright deal. And eventually that helped the Bulls to finally get over the championship hump, having Cartwright on the team. But Jordan really loved Oakley. And eventually Oakley wound up playing for Toronto. This guy, Ray, who was working for the Raptors, got to know Oakley pretty well. And Oakley said one night, hey, after the game, do you want to have dinner with me and a friend? And Ray was like, yeah, sure, no problem. So he said, okay, cool. So they hop into they sort of like hop out of the arena, and they're kind of waiting for a car to pull up. And this huge stretch limo pulls up, and the door opens, and the friend, of course, is Michael Jordan. So he's like, get in. So he had dinner with Charles Oakley and Michael Jordan, and we were like, well, what did you say to him? He's like, I didn't say anything, man. I just sat there and listened as they were talking and everything, and it was just kind of cool to be there. So that's a neat story as well. So yeah,
absolutely.
Well, thanks, Nancy.
No, definitely.
Well, thanks, Nancy, for calling in. Really appreciate that anecdote. That was great. Appreciate that. That was Nancy calling from Mount Prospect, Illinois. We're going to go now to Sunny, who's calling from Austin, Texas. Sunny, welcome to the show.
Hey, I'll use your a little snippet there about the going to the boxing gym for as a segue into this one, from the best in basketball to the best in boxing. But this is somebody that I definitely wouldn't have said I admired before meeting them, if mm-hmm. anything, indifferent. But I was a huge boxing fan, and my job took me to Las Vegas. And my son was a boxer. And so we boxed at one of the gyms that he went to regularly. He went to two gyms just religiously, but one of them was Mayweather's boxing gym. Mm. And at the time, Floyd Mayweather Jr. was retired. And so he wasn't ever at the gym. And so, you know, for a year, it never really crossed the mind that, you know, of meeting him. And then one day, you know, Floyd started coming back into the gym. This was before he had announced that he wasn't retiring. And just briefly after that, we would talk to Floyd every single day for about 5 years.
Wow.
Just the same way you and I are talking now. And the difference in his character on in public, you know, he kind of is the heel in a public persona. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason mm-hmm. behind that. At the time when he came out, De La Hoya had already come out. Right. He was kind of the golden boy. And so
exactly.
there was kind of all mm-hmm. he realized after a couple of years in boxing, there was only enough room for, you know, kind of one good guy. So he kind of started playing into the bad guy mm-hmm. role. And he would go out of his way to bring us into conversations. He would clear the gym whenever it was training, and he would let me and my son. But one of the things that I wanted to mention was like just two brief instances that show what his character was like. One time he threw down his hand wraps. He would have custom hand wraps each time he sparred. And afterwards, you know, he cut them off. And he handed them to my son, and I happened to, my job, I'm an electrician, so I'd have a Sharpie marker with me, and I'd come there after work every day. And so I happened to have a Sharpie, and I said, well, why don't you ask Floyd to sign them? And Floyd signed them, you know, he put my son's name, and then he put God bless. And, you know, it's just kind of wouldn't something you would have gone out of your way to place with his, at least the character. And another time we were both sitting together on the side of the ring talking, just like you and I are talking now, and a reporter from the New York Times walked up. And so this kind of thing was kind of common. There was always somebody. And so Floyd would kind of ask them, you know, who they were with to see if he would give them an interview. So the guy said he was with the New York Times, and Floyd said, you know, okay. And so the guy starts asking him questions, and Floyd cuts him off one time, and he says, you know, hold on. Humility doesn't mean sitting in your house, being quiet, doing nothing. Humility means knowing that you're blessed by God, and that's where your gifts come from.
Wow.
And I just thought that was
a great quote.
I could have heard in a homily.
Yeah.
I thought. And it didn't get quoted by the New York Times article. I've never heard anybody quote any Floyd saying anything like that. It doesn't, you know, kind of fit to the heel persona. But that's just not the guy that we knew.
Well, that's very interesting, Sonny. Yes, I appreciate that call. Sonny calling from Austin. That's an interesting take that Floyd Mayweather, you know, may have adopted a persona like maybe in professional wrestling, like somebody's got to be the bad guy. Certainly one of the greatest boxers of his generation and perhaps of all time. And I don't know. Just don't try to steal his hat like Logan Paul did the other day. And he's fighting YouTube star Logan Paul. And folks, please do not buy this fight. This is not a good use of your funds on any level. I really just don't understand this at all. This makes the McGregor fight look pretty legit to me. But at any rate, so Floyd, you should just stay retired, man. Don't tarnish your legacy doing stuff like this. But that's a great line. And so, Sonny, I really appreciate that call. And thanks for listening to the program. It's Sonny calling from Austin, Texas, with an interesting story about getting to know Floyd Mayweather. And I think what Floyd said to that reporter is quite interesting, this idea that humility is not like sort of this attitude, oh, I'm terrible at everything, you know, and I'm just, you know, oh, shucks. It's actually using the gifts that God gave you. And we all have them. We all have spiritual gifts. We all have things that only really we can do. And it's not sinful at all to recognize that and to recognize and celebrate the gifts of others, the gifts that God gave other people as well. And so, yes, use your gifts. Don't say, oh, you know, it's not for me. Someone else can do it. If God's given you a gift, by all means, he's done that for a reason. He wants you to put it to good use for the kingdom. Appreciate that. That was Sunny in Austin. We're going to go now to Jose calling from Bellflower, California. Jose, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Cale. How are you?
I'm great. I'm great. Thanks for calling in. Did you meet somebody?
Yes. So, I was in the Navy. Actually, I'm retired. But in 1991, when I was in active duty, I met Colin Powell aboard the USS Missouri battleship.
Oh, wow.
In Pearl Harbor. We were having the celebration of the 50th anniversary of Pearl Harbor bombing.
Mm-hmm.
And the main guests were George Bush, President George Bush, their dad, Barbara Bush, and I was a cook, what they would call back then. It was a mess management specialist, and I was part of security. And I was just sitting there on a flight deck, and then all of a sudden I see this gentleman walk up to me, and it was General Colin Powell.
Wow.
And he greeted, he came up to me, and he greeted me, and I said, oh, my goodness, Colin Powell, what should I say? Nothing, I said. So he comes up to me and says, Sam, where are you from? And I said, actually, I was raised in the Bronx, New York. And it's all you did. I said, and he goes, I'm from the Bronx. I said, really, sir?
Wow.
He goes, you are, yes. And he goes, what high school you went to? I said, well, I graduated from Morris High School in the Bronx. And he said, I graduated from Morris High School in the
You're
Bronx.
You're kidding.
And I said, sir, you're pulling my leg, aren't you? I said, no, son, seriously, when you go back to home, you go to the school, you get the yearbook, and you look me up. And actually did that back in 91. And, he suddenly graduated from there. So it was an amazing experience.
Oh, that is an amazing experience. That's great. And thank you for your service as well. That's awesome.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, that's amazing. And how many years have you been retired now, Jose?
I retired in 2015. I served 23 and a half years in the Navy.
Wow. God bless you. That's incredible. I'm sure you had some amazing adventures along the way.
Oh, yes. But let me tell you, Kel, that out of all those experiences I had, that was one of the most memorable that I had.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, Colin Powell, obviously a very distinguished figure in the military and in the political realm as well. So Jose, calling from Bellflower, California, really, thank you for that anecdote. That's great. I appreciate that. And one other thing, too, my professor, Dr. Craig Evans, who's been on the program before, one of his very best friends growing up, eventually went on to work for the Secret Service. And he served under George Bush Sr., and also W as well, when he was president. And he said the Bush family was wonderful to work for. Told one story about how the Secret Service agents obviously have to be on guard no matter what. And there was one occasion when Lucas, who was George W. Bush's wife again? I'm drawing a blank here. Laura Bush, yes. Laura Bush apparently was just a real sweetheart. There was a meeting going on in one room of the White House, and it was raining outside, and she noticed that the Secret Service agents were standing outside in the rain. She moved the entire meeting to a different room so that they could come inside and not get soaked. Not too many people would have noticed that, but that was kind of lady she was. So really kind of a related anecdote, I guess, a little bit. So you're listening to The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. We will be right back after this quick break. Hang on. Newman's coming. You can say hello to him right after this. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
explaining the faith so you can explain it to others. It's the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Hey, welcome back to the show. Kind of fun little segment here talking about famous people that you may have met. You ever met your hero or somebody that you really admired or was really well known? And it was a positive experience, maybe not so positive. Let me know. 1-888-914-9149 is the number to call. And one person who was, of course, very much present in the Last Dance documentary was Jerry Seinfeld, the comedy of the 90s. The Bulls were the team of the 90s. It makes sense. Well, of course, one thing that Newman was very Seinfeld was very famous for was saying, "Hello, Newman." So let's do that right now.
Kramer!
Hello, Newman. Hello, Newman. Hello, Newman. Hello, Newman.
Hello, Newman.
Hello, Newman.
And of course, by Newman, we mean St. John Henry Newman, otherwise known as Cardinal Newman. And for every day in the month of May, he wrote a little reflection about Our Lady, because May is the month dedicated to Our Lady, of course. And I want to talk about what he said about this interesting title of Mary from the Litany of Loretto, that Mary is the mirror of justice. Now, this is something that when we hear this, we think, oh, that's really interesting. But what does this mean, that Mary is the mirror of justice? Have you ever wondered that? Well, here's what Cardinal Newman says, and I quote, "Here we must first consider what is meant by justice, for the word as used by the Church does not have the sense which it bears in ordinary English. By justice is not meant the virtue of fairness, equity, uprightness in all our dealings, but it is a word denoting all virtues at once, a perfect, virtuous state of soul, righteousness or moral perfection, so that it answers very nearly to what is meant by sanctity. Therefore, when Our Lady is called the mirror of justice, it is meant to say that she is the mirror of sanctity, of holiness, of supernatural goodness." What is meant by calling her a mirror? A mirror, of course, is a surface which reflects, just like still water, polished steel, or a looking glass. What did Mary reflect? She reflected our Lord, but he is infinite sanctity, infinite holiness. She then, as far as a creature could, reflected his divine sanctity, and therefore she is the mirror of sanctity, or as the litany says, the mirror of justice. Do we ask how she came to reflect his sanctity? Well, it was by living with him. We see every day how like people get to each other who live with those whom they love. When they live with those whom they don't love, as for instance the members of a family who quarrel with each other, then the longer they live together, the more unlike each other they become. But when they love each other as husband and wife, parents and children, brothers with brothers or sisters, friends with friends, then in the course of time they get surprisingly like each other. All of us perceive this. We are witnesses to it with our own eyes and ears, in the expression of their features, in their voice, in their walk, in their language, even in their handwriting. They become like each other, and so with regard to their minds, as in their opinions, their tastes, their pursuits, and again, doubtless in the state of their souls, which we do not see, whether for good or for bad. I think that's an interesting point by Cardinal Newman, that people tend to be like people that they love. People, we see this in families all the time. We've often heard it said, oh, that couple that's been married for 50 years, they even kind of look like each other. You know, and some people say even you begin to resemble your dog, you know, after a while. But we also see, as Newman said, when people really fight with one another, maybe siblings that have a sibling, you know, fight or disagreement that goes on for decades, they become more unlike each other. I don't want to be like that guy. But when they love each other, they become very much alike. And certainly, I mean, even in the case of physical appearance, I think our Lord would have looked a lot like Our Lady, because, of course, she got, you know, she gave him all of his DNA from a human point of view. So I think they had a lot of resemblances on a lot of levels. But Newman continues on here just really quickly. "Consider that Mary loved her divine Son with an unutterable love. And consider, too, she had him all to herself for 30 years. Do we not see that as she was full of grace before she conceived him in her womb, she must have had a vast, incomprehensible sanctity when she had lived close to God for 30 years, a sanctity of an angelical order, reflecting back the attributes of God, with a fullness and exactness of which no saint upon earth or hermit or holy virgin can even remind us. Truly, then, she is the mirror of divine perfection. So that's amazing. Of course, the Immaculate Conception of Our Lady put her on another level to begin with, but then just hanging out with God incarnate for 30 years, wow, that'll also make you the mirror of divine sanctity, divine justice, to be sure. So cool reflection there by Cardinal Newman for another day in this month of May dedicated to Our Lady. We're going to go back to the phones right now. We're going to go to Bonnie calling from one of my favorite cities in the world, San Diego, California. Bonnie, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I wanted to share with you the story. We lived in a neighborhood where our in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. and a friend of ours who was a priest had been asked to pick up Mother Teresa from the airport. And so the next morning he said to me, I'm going to visit Mother Teresa at her convent here in D.C. Would you like to go with me? And I said, yes, may I bring my daughter, who was at the time just 18 months old. And Mother Teresa was there, and we got to sit and visit with her. She took my daughter and put her face in her hands and gave her a kiss.
Oh, wow.
So I've always told my daughter that she was kissed by a saint.
That's amazing. I'm guessing you probably didn't get a picture of that moment.
No. No,
yeah.
This was in 1981. We
didn't right.
have cell phones, and I didn't think enough. I was so excited about getting the opportunity, I didn't take a camera with me. It really upset me later, but...
Well, I'm sure that
I have it envisioned in my mind perfectly.
Oh, I was just going to say, yeah, I'm sure it's just emblazoned in your memory. So, yeah, if only you had had a handy cell phone camera at that time. But that's amazing, and... It's incredible too. Like a lot of saints, like Mother Teresa and Pope John Paul II, who met so many people during their lifetime, you constantly hear from people who have met them how, despite the fact that they must have been tired, this sort of thing can wear you out. But everyone always says he made me feel or she made me feel like I was the only person there in the room at that moment when he's talking to me, when he's dealing with me. And I'm sure that was probably the case also with Mother Teresa, right?
Oh, yes. And she was so tiny and so frail, but you felt this amazing peace with her. Oh,
wow.
It was amazing.
That's incredible. Yeah, the peace of Christ, communicated to someone who was really close to him. That's amazing. Thank you very much for that call, Bonnie. That's a great story. Appreciate
and
that.
I love your show. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Very kind. Very kind. Please pray for me. Thanks, Bonnie. We'll pray for you, too. We're going to go now to RJ, who's calling from San Francisco. Hi, RJ.
Hi. How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks for calling.
Good to talk to you. I would have liked to have met Fulton Sheen or John Paul II or Pope Pius X or the 12th.
Yeah.
But I met Cassius Clay.
Muhammad Ali. Mm-hmm.
It was an amazing thing to see him. Shocker. I was getting on an elevator in Boston, going upstairs to my room, and he was getting off on the main floor, and he was with Howard Cosell in that elevator, and there was just the two of them there.
Wow.
And it was like, it just shocked me.
And
he was so big and overpowering looking, but he probably wasn't any more than bigger than I am now.
What year was this, RJ?
In the 70s.
In the 70s, yeah, when he was at the height of his fame.
Yes, the big time. And I used to see him at the Madison Square Garden fight because I traveled a lot. And I used to see him in there in New York fight, and then to see him get off that... elevator. What a
Well,
what a but it's too bad what happened with him.
Yeah, absolutely. And RJ, thanks so much for that call. And obviously, Muhammad Ali was probably, I mean, next to the Pope, maybe the most famous person on the planet at that time. And very similar to being Michael Jordan. And that's one thing that the producers of The Last Dance noted in this Chicago Tribune article. This guy could never really be alone. Every time he stepped out of an elevator, went out in public, he couldn't go to movies because people would just mob this guy. Michael, Michael, Michael. And it was the same with Ali as well. And the great Howard Cosell, one of the great sports broadcasters of all time. And I think I'm going to do the rest of the show in my Howard Cosell voice. I want to tell you that Lucas Holt produced the show today. He is a firecracker. Let me tell you, he's got a lot of potential. Patrick Alog worked the phones. He was that friendly voice on the other line when you called. And I got to tell you, you have been an incredible crowd, an incredible audience today on the Cale Clark Show. And we'll be back with much more tomorrow. Hey, speaking of sports, one of the nicest guys in the world, former NHL All-Star MVP John Scott will be on the show tomorrow. Can't wait. And I'll see you then. Take it away, Michaela.
Thank you for listening to my daddy.